progressive voice of Minnesota. Welcome on into the Wednesday edition of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, joined by Sasha on the other side of the production glass. Sasha, how are things going with you today?
Not bad, not bad. A lot of work today at the station, but I'm staying on top of it.
Yeah, a little work for me as well today. If you heard earlier this morning, we unfortunately went off the air for a few minutes as we had a raccoon chew through some wiring that goes out to our tower. So that's always fun.
These alt-right trolls.
There you go. Yeah. Someone's out there chewing through those wires. So always fun in the radio business. So that's pretty much been my morning as we've been out there trying to get that all fixed up. Let's get to the news of today, though, as we are joined by our first guest, Patrick Kulikin. He is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Great resource to find out what's happening in the local Minnesota political scene, as we have a number of topics to go through today. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Absolutely. So I want to start off on this first story, which on the surface sounds really nice. We have an historic part of Fort Snelling that is going to redevelop part of their buildings into 191 affordable housing units. Yeah, that certainly sounds nice. That's until you take a look at the price tag, because each of these units are going to cost $900,000 to remodel into apartment units. That's not how much the mortgage or the rent is going to be, but that's how much it'll cost to redevelop these things. And yesterday, the Hennepin County Board approved $88 million in bonds for this Fort Snelling Upper Post project that, again, is going to convert some of their old buildings into apartment units. But as I brought up, this is a very, very steep cost. So, Patrick, you've been following this story for a while. How on earth are each of these units going to cost $900,000 to remodel?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's no question. there is no question that it is expensive when you've got these crumbling historic buildings, and because they're using historic tax credits, reconstruction tax credits, they have to preserve them. It's also sort of a brownfield site, so there's cleanup they have to do with lead and asbestos abatement. And somehow you get to $900,000, and that has grown since 2018, I think by 60-something percent. It's increased just in the last couple of years. So, it's an eye-popping number, and it's leaving a lot of people across the political spectrum with some questions.
Yeah, and again, it sounds like this is mostly going to be financed through tax dollars, hence why it needed the approval of the Hennepin County Board. And as you brought up, it's an interesting dynamic to look at in terms of who supports this project and who is against it, because it doesn't necessarily follow along traditional party lines where it's Democrats who are in favor of the project and Republicans who are against, or the other way around where Republicans are in favor, Democrats are against. It's really coming from both sides of the political aisle when we look at who supports this project, because they're balancing the fact that, well, we do want to redevelop this old historic building and not have it torn down, but there are others who rightfully point out that this is an awfully steep price to pay to redevelop these buildings.
Yeah, and for folks on the liberal side, as Margaret Kaplan pointed out in our reporting, this kind of project can be weaponized by the other side to say, well, you know, we don't really need, if we're going to allow these people to spend with such profligacy $900,000 per quote unquote affordable housing unit, then they don't really need any money because they clearly don't know how to spend money wisely. And so that's the danger here. In addition to just a massive use of resources for very few units, I would also point out that it's not really affordable. I mean, it's moderately priced, but it's really just the average price for a Twin Cities apartment. So it's although there's a preference for veterans, it's not actually it's not required that the developer rent to veterans. They also don't have to rent to Section 8. They don't have to honor Section 8 housing vouchers. They say they will, but they don't have to. There are various ways that they can avoid renting to people. So I think the project tells a compelling story, and that's that we're going to take homeless veterans or something and put them into these nice new units, and it's a set of historic buildings that played an important role in World War II and so forth, and it's this nice story, but it's really not quite accurate because you're gonna actually have to earn a fair income or somehow have some decent income to afford these places, and there's other problems with it. It's right by the airport. There's nothing really. It's not like there's great access from this site to services or to even just a grocery store or anything. So pretty problematic. Private developer by the name of Dominium that has been very effective in cobbling together public money, tax-free bonds, and so forth, as well as private money and creating quote-unquote affordable housing that actually comes in often at more than $500,000 per unit. So they've, good on them, it's shrewd, but I don't think this is what most people think of when they think of affordable housing, especially in light of the fact that rents have climbed so much in the last 20 years, way ahead of incomes. And we have this homelessness crisis that the pandemic has worsened. This just doesn't really seem like a great use of taxpayer dollars.
Well, and another aspect is that, well, it comes down to what you define as affordable housing. As Max Desterak reports in the Minnesota Reformer in his piece he wrote about this, the units are technically reserved for people making 60% of the area median income or less, which is currently about $43,000 if you're a single person or $62,000 if you're a four-person household. And rents will be capped at about $1,200 for a one-bedroom place and $1,400 for a two-bedroom apartment, which is pretty much the same as the average rent you would find at any other one- or two-bedroom apartment in the Twin Cities. So that's another aspect in that when they define it as affordable housing, as I think you said earlier, that doesn't necessarily mean these are all going to be Section 8. It's just affordable housing in terms of what it means compared to the average median income, which I brought up is $43,000. And boy, I can think of a lot of veterans and people who are going through economic tough times that are making nowhere near $43,000 a year.
Right, the average Black Minnesotan or the average Indigenous Minnesotan makes less than that. Median makes less than that. So, I mean, who are we talking about here? I think another wrinkle to this story is that state housing officials realize that this is just kind of a little bit nutty, and they have a cap where if a project is too much per unit cost, then they can reject use of public a bonding authority. But the developer with some allies of the legislature, they went and got themselves some high-powered lobbying firms, and they essentially got the legislature to override that cap in 2018 in some legislative a show of legislative influence that I've rarely seen, at least here in Minnesota. It was quite something to behold. It's all legal, but it certainly just kind of feels like it doesn't really feel like good government.
So is this pretty much a done deal now, or are there any additional steps that the developer Dominion is going to have to take to get this project off the ground and built?
No, they're basically there. There's a state board that, again, traditionally could put a stop to this, but the legislature has instructed the executive branch to approve the project. So that their hands are tied.
And as you brought up, yeah, this went through the state legislature, and I, of course, was assumed it was signed by the governor, which at the time, if you're talking 2018, I think that would have been Mark Dayton, which means, yeah, this thing probably had bipartisan support, or if not bipartisan support, at least not enough opposition for anyone to say, hey, we need to take this out of so-and-so bill. So, yeah, it looks like
what they do is they tucked it into a much larger bill.
Right.
Where, you know, the governor had a lot of priorities he wanted in that bill, and so he signed it.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, one of those cases where, well, we're not really going to do much and blow up the entire bill just to get rid of this one little provision that would impact this housing project at Fort Snelling. So, unfortunately, yeah, that's kind of the sausage making of government sometimes and how you can get some really bad things put into bills that probably shouldn't be there.
That's right.
All right. Let's go on to another topic here, Patrick. Again, we are speaking with Patrick Kulikin, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, website minnesotareformer.com. And let's talk about this Republican pledge that was made yesterday, or as I believe it's technically called, the Republican contract to reopen Minnesota. Essentially, this is the Minnesota Republican Party's plan to reopen the state should they happen to take both chambers of the state legislature. Recorder Lopez was reporting on this earlier this week in the Reformer that one of the main aspects highlighted in this Republican contract is that it would encourage people in the state to comply with mask wearing and social distancing, which, as you pointed out in your newsletter today, encouraging people to do something is a lot different than requiring people to do something. When you encourage people, generally that's not going to happen. It's mostly got to be kind of a requirement if you actually want people to do the action that you intend.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at their plan, I mean, I don't mean to be partisan here, but there's not really a plan. It's encourage people to wear masks, encourage people to socially distance, encourage businesses to follow CDC guidelines. But, I mean, that's, so people are, especially given the amount of misinformation and disinformation about COVID-19, including most especially from the President of the United States, there's a lot of people who are downplaying the risks of the virus. They don't think they can get it, or they think if they get it, they'll be fine. And that's just a recipe for rapid spread and really dangerous consequences for people who are vulnerable, either because they're older or because they have other health problems. And a lot of Americans, because of our obesity rate and so forth, are at high risk. So, yeah, they want to encourage everybody, but they're not. They don't want to mandate behavior. And I mean, you really see this. It's sort of in a microcosm of their entire governing philosophy. They don't think businesses should be mandated or required to do anything. And they just are hoping that people can more or less police themselves, which, I mean, the reason we have government is because people are not good at policing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and what's also interesting to watch is that politically, their timing could not be worse, because the virus is spreading rapidly in the upper Midwest, even faster in our neighboring states, but is really taking off in Minnesota just in the past week especially. It's basically considered a kind of uncontrolled spread. I think most Minnesotans, they want to remain safe. They want to keep their families safe. And so, you know, we can argue around the edges about, you know, should schools be back in session? You know, how fierce should the restrictions be and so forth? But this idea that we're all going to head to our favorite bar and start yelling jokes at each other is just, it's preposterous. I guess they're speaking to their base on this, but I don't think they're speaking to the voters that they really ought need to be speaking to, and especially in the suburbs.
Yeah, and as you guys have been reporting on this story, I would really be interested to the reaction of some of these very vulnerable Republican state senators, because as you brought up, this is really not a very popular message if you're trying to win back those suburban independents who have drifted towards the Democratic Party over the past few years. And I just have a tough time seeing this being a winning message, especially when I think it was a few days ago, and I'm blanking on the name of the Republican, who he's a member of the state legislature that accidentally sent a message to all of the state legislatures when it was only intended for his fellow Republicans that essentially said, please don't talk about the coronavirus. It's not a winning issue for us. And lo and behold, a few days later, the Republican leadership puts out this plan, which highlights again their response to COVID-19, which for the most part has not been very popular in Minnesota or really the entire country. So it'd be interesting to think about how some of these very vulnerable suburban Republican politicians are thinking about this plan that was put out there, because while this certainly fires up the base in some of these rural districts in suburbia, where Republicans have to win to have success this fall, doesn't strike me that this is going to be a very effective message.
Right. Consider that the two guys delivering the message are Kirk Dowd, the House Minority Leader, and Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka. They're both from very safe rural districts or greater Minnesota districts, so they don't have to worry about persuading voters in their districts or in their races. But if you think about the Minnetonka seat that's now an open seat in the state Senate, or Dan Hall's seat where two Democrats won in the House in 2018. Those are the kinds of races that are going to determine who controls the legislature next year. And open up just doesn't liberate Minnesota, if you will. That just doesn't seem like a winning message in the face of a pandemic that has really come back at us very hard in the last few weeks.
Well, it's interesting, too. One of our other on-air hosts brought up this point yesterday when he was talking about this letter, and you can just tell a difference in terms of how both parties kind of message whichever candidates they have running for office, where for the Republicans, as we're seeing right here, it's kind of a one-size-fits-all message, no matter if you're in a very safe Republican red district or one of those more purple suburban districts, versus let's take a look at the DFL approach, where they have a very wide variety of people running for office, where the host I was referring to yesterday, Matt McNeil, brought up the point that, well, in the DFL, you would never have Ilhan Omar run under Colin Peterson's platform, just like you would never have Colin Peterson run under Ilhan Omar's platform, which shows that on the Democratic side, they are very much aware that they do need to message depending on what race they're talking about, where for the Republicans, they kind of do take this one-size-fits-all approach, and well, damn the results if it ends up hurting some of our candidates down ballot.
Yeah, this is the challenge of governing as a majority party.
Mm-hmm.
You have to put together a big coalition because it's a big country and Minnesota is a big, diverse state. And so you have to put together that coalition. And it can be difficult and messy and contentious, and it's going to be even more so after this election if it goes, if it winds up being a big Democratic year, as the polls indicate it could, then, you know, keeping that coalition together is going to be very challenging. But yeah, if you want to be the minority party, the kind of rump regional party, it's kind of easy because you all agree with each other and you run under that same banner. You're just going to have a tough time winning statewide races, as Minnesota Republicans have here. They haven't won since 2006. And you're going to have a tough time on a national level winning national elections if you're just going to be a kind of one-size-fits-all deal. They've lost six out of the last seven presidential popular votes. So that's a choice they may have to make after this election. But the Democrats have their own challenge keeping that messy, large coalition together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, especially when you have a party that has Colin Peterson on one side and Ilhan Omar on the other. That is also a very challenging coalition to keep together and keep united. All right, Patrick, one more topic I want to talk about with you. And you, of course, are someone who's passionate about making sure people follows what's happening at the state legislature and some of these state legislature elections. And one of the races you've been highlighting over the past few days is a very competitive state Senate seat we have in the Bemidji Grand Rapids area in northern Minnesota, where we have State Senator Justin Eichhorn, who was just elected back in 2016, being challenged by the mayor of Bemidji, Rita Albrecht, who is a very popular figure up in that area. And well, despite the fact that this district was very Republican in 2016, Albrecht, again, the Democratic challenger, very popular up in that neck of the woods. And this is creating one of the more competitive state Senate races we're seeing this fall, correct?
Yeah, it's an interesting race because it's an area that went Trump heavily, and I think by 7,000 votes in 16, certainly. And and Eichhorn won largely on that, on the basis of the regional tilt. I think that he was the Senate district chair and couldn't find anyone to run and just put his own name in. And next thing you know, he's in the state Senate. Albrecht has a great resume, well-known, is the mayor of the largest city in the district. And so she, that's a big advantage. But she may be just fighting some serious headwinds in greater Minnesota that Democrats are facing these days. But it should be interesting. I think she's probably going to make it interesting. And as I noted, it's a little bit of a mirror situation from the suburbs, where the Senate Minority Leader, Susan Kent, has great tailwinds as a Democrat, and Joe Biden running strong in the suburbs. But she does face Mary Giuliani Stevens, who is the former mayor of Woodbury. So even though being a Republican in Woodbury is probably a disadvantage, she does have the advantage of some name recognition from having been mayor. So it'll be interesting to see how these races play out, and whether or not party label matters as much as I suspect it does.
Yeah, when you look at those types of races for a legislative seat, and I'm talking both the state legislature or even in the U.S. Congress, when you get an executive, whether it be a mayor or a governor, or challenging someone for a legislative seat, oftentimes you do have that executive, again, a mayor or a governor, with higher name recognition, which, yeah, could end up boosting Rita Albrecht up in northern Minnesota, or the former Woodbury mayor, Mary Giuliani Stevens in Woodbury, the Republican challenger to Susan Kent. So, yeah, those are going to be races that are interesting to watch, because that's kind of a trend I've seen the past few years, where sometimes you have these people who come from executive positions in politics, the executive branch of government, who sometimes do have success once they run for the state legislature or U.S. Congress. And, yeah, that very well could be the case in some of these state Senate races this fall.
Yes, name recognition in these legislative races is shockingly low, and so a mayor can overcome some of that because they're a little bit better known. And I do want to point out that the Senate right now is 35-32, narrow Republican majority. Each of these races, there's probably 10 or 12, could determine the fate of the next legislature. And it's not just the next legislative session, with the budget deficit and the pandemic and everything else, but they're also they're going to be doing redistricting. So an all DFL legislature will shape the state's future for the next decade. But if Republicans can keep one of the legislative chambers or both, we'll probably wind up with the courts redrawing our maps again. But that's the legislature is going to have a huge challenge next year, and I hope that your listeners are paying close attention to these races, because they're really important.
Absolutely, and especially in a census/redistricting year, which we are experiencing here in 2020. That's Patrick Coolican. He is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Website is minnesotareformer.com, a great resource to find the latest on Minnesota political news. Patrick, as always, thanks for the time today.
Great to be here. Thanks again.
All right, we'll take a break and come on back with more here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
With all the convenient big box stores that sell appliances, why do so many Minnesotans choose Warner Stellion? Check online to learn that Warner Stellion is a Minnesota family-owned business for over 60 years. Warner Stellion sells more brands than anyone else, and our passionate specialists are committed to impressing you so much that you'll refer us to everyone you know. That's our mission here at Warner Stellion. Ask around. Check us out online. And when it's your time to buy appliances, join over 300,000 Minnesota homeowners and choose the specialists, Warner Stellion.
All of us want to make a difference. As veterans, we committed to protect our country. We served and sacrificed for the things that mattered most. Those experiences shaped our lives. Now we're husbands, wives, parents, and friends. And sometimes we forget that the biggest challenge can be asking for support. The Veterans Crisis Line is here for veterans. Dial 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. It matters.
Being in the Army National Guard is about more than serving your country. It's about being there for your community when your neighbors need you most. The Army National Guard makes college affordable, and serving part-time can help you graduate debt-free. Do you want to stay close to friends and family? The Guard allows you to serve close to home. Serving part-time in the Army National Guard lets you have the life you want. Learn more by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard, aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
Even though these are challenging times, All Energy Solar is still committed to providing you a cost-effective, environmentally friendly energy system through their zero-contact protocol. Solar remains a great value and long-term investment, but some of the incentive programs will be expiring soon. All Energy Solar can walk you through the entire process. They can evaluate your property by phone or webinar, and can even complete preliminary design work without visiting your home. So start saving on your energy bill today and visit allenergysolar.com.
You know how it is with vacuum cleaners. You buy them, you break them, then you throw them away, right? Well, not necessarily. Often, fixing your vacuum can be cheaper than replacing it. Ever heard of A1 Vacuum in Roseville? They offer free estimates. So if you wish your vacuum worked like new again, drop by. A1 Vacuum is ready to help clean up your vacuum cleaner act. Find us at a-1vacuum.com or call 651-222-6316.
The number one source of the Twin Cities gay scene is All Digital. Follow Twin Cities Gay Scene on Facebook and Twitter. Sign up for the Scene Shot email blast for weekly updates and chances to win great prizes. No app is needed to view the bi-weekly web editions of Scene. It's GLBTQ media for the mobile generation. Find it all at TwinCitiesGayScene.com. That's TwinCitiesGayScene.com.
Would you let animals pick your insurance? Do you really need to experience mayhem to get the best rates? Or how about a celebrity quarterback or fake university saving you money? There's a lot of marketing stunts when it comes to insurance, but what you really need is someone looking out for you. Call Array Insurance, and they will work hard to find you the best insurance coverage and rates. So avoid gimmicks and call Cheryl at Array, 763-504-3067 or arrayinsurance.com. Array Insurance, working hard for you.
When's a good time for a 5-hour energy shot? At work, when deadlines are tight.
I need it on my desk by 5.
Okay, got it.
When you have to work late.
Hey, looks like another late one. Not sure when I'll be home.
When the afternoon lull strikes. 5-hour energy is made for hardworking people like you. Just crack it open, knock it back, and get ready for the alert, energized feeling you need to get stuff done. For more information, visit 5hourenergy.com.
AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So following up on what we were talking about in that last segment, the messaging of the Republican Party this fall and how they've largely come to a one-size-fits-all message, at least with the COVID-19 pandemic and their little contract to reopen Minnesota. And I was talking about how, yeah, that really wouldn't work on the Democratic side since you have such a wide variety of politicians that fall on many different places on the political spectrum, where, of course, you have Collin Peterson, who certainly falls on the side of being a more conservative Democrat, versus Ilhan Omar and Betty McCollum, who are certainly among the most progressive Democrats, where at least at the state level, the state Democratic Party, the DFL, seems to do a better job at reading the room than the Minnesota State Republican Party. And, of course, there's evidence to back that up in the fact that Minnesota Republicans have not won a statewide election since 2006. Now, I had a listener a few days ago email me about this and say, well, is this just the fault of Jennifer Carnahan, the current chairwoman of the Republican Party? And really, it's not. Now, I'm not saying she's necessarily done a great job as the chair of the Minnesota Republican Party. They have lost a whole bunch of legislative seats and had the DFL flip the State House of Representatives back in 2018. And she certainly tied herself to the Donald Trump presidency. But I think it even goes beyond her. Look back to 2010 and 2011, for instance, when Tony Sutton was the chair of the Republican Party and how, well, he and his other cohorts nearly bankrupted the party. If you remember back to the earlier part of the 2010s decade, I even remember the Republican Party got practically evicted out of their headquarters in Minneapolis at that time because they were bankrupt. They had no money to even pay their rent. So it's certainly a problem that goes beyond just the past few years with the state GOP here in Minnesota having trouble winning elections. And I'm not sure this idea of having a contract to reopen Minnesota and saying, well, just get rid of all COVID regulations and let things run wild. I'm not sure that's really going to be a good strategy come this fall for the Republican Party. But if you're someone who supports the DFL, well, then that's a message that probably is going to lead to even more success for Democrats in the state at the state legislature and down ballot. I want to switch gears now and talk about a national news story and something that popped up on my Twitter feed this morning as I was gathering some political news. And it has to do with a video that was put out in the state of Utah. The current governor of Utah is a Republican by the name of Spencer Cox. And he is being challenged by a Democrat by the name of Chris Peterson. And both of these guys, even though they're campaigning against each other this fall, released a joint campaign ad. Yeah, they cooperated with each other to create a political ad. I want you to listen to the audio of this because I'll provide a little analysis on this video that both Spencer Cox and Chris Peterson made. But for now, let's go ahead and listen to that audio right now from this joint campaign commercial.
I'm Spencer Cox, your Republican candidate for Utah governor.
And I'm Chris Peterson, your Democratic candidate for governor.
We are currently in the final days of campaigning against each other.
But our common values transcend our political differences, and the strength of our nation rests on our ability to see that.
We are both equally dedicated to the American values of democracy, liberty, and justice for all people.
We just have different opinions on how to achieve those ideals.
But today, we are setting aside those differences to deliver a message that is critical for the health of our nation.
That whether you vote by mail or in person, we will fully support the results of the upcoming presidential election, regardless of the outcome.
Although we sit on different sides of the aisle, we are both committed to American civility and a peaceful transition of power.
And we hope Utah will be an example to the nation.
Because that is what our country is built on.
Please stand with us on behalf of our great state and nation.
My name's Spencer Cox.
And I'm Chris Peterson.
And we approve this message.
So a lot of people and media outlets have been reacting to this video saying, isn't it how great how Democrats and Republicans came together to make this video? I hate to be a little cynical about this, but I'm not quite as pumped up in thinking that this is some sort of way that we can have Democrats and Republicans come together. There's a couple of things to point out with this Utah governor's race. Well, A, Spencer Cox, the incumbent Republican, is leading in the polls by about 30 percentage points. So this is not a competitive race whatsoever. So neither Cox nor Peterson really had anything to lose by making this joint campaign appearance when it's pretty clear that the Republican Spencer Cox is going to win this fall. But even if we just look beyond that fact and realize that, well, if they were in a more competitive race, I very much doubt you would have these guys putting together a joint campaign video. But in the current political climate, is that necessarily the best image to be having of two political opponents standing together and making their own joint campaign video? On the surface, yeah, it is a good message. But I don't know, as I think about the current era we're in with Donald Trump and all of the lies we hear from Republicans, it is hard to come together and say, well, we just disagree on the issues, especially when you have someone that, well, thinks the sky is red when the sky is really blue. Yeah, you can have disagreements, let's say, about tax policy or other financial issues when it comes to government, but when it comes to what facts really are, that's not one of those things where you can agree to disagree. So I don't know, I'm a little more pessimistic about this joint video that was put together by both of these Utah candidates for governor. And like I said, I would be very skeptical that they would be making a joint campaign video if it were a closer race. All right, let's take things back to Minnesota for a few more stories before we head to break. This is one more reminder to make sure that you turn over your ballot when you vote this fall and vote in those state judicial elections. Michelle McDonald is a Republican who is trying to knock off current Supreme Court Justice Paul Thiessen, who used to be the Democratic Speaker of the State House of Representatives. Michelle McDonald is challenging Paul Thiessen, even though, as I've brought up a couple other times on the show, McDonald does have quite the checkered history, including, well, essentially being kicked out of the Republican Party, having a few are actually being charged with drunken driving back in 2013 and then having some issues with the judge in that case. She's also been tied to the Sandra Grazzini-Ruckey child disappearance case where basically Grazzini-Ruckey kidnapped her own children even though she didn't have custody. Michelle McDonald was kind of involved in that case. I could go on, but read her background on this and realize why it's important to vote on those on the back of that ballot in elections that have to do with the judicial branch, especially when we have this added to the background of Michelle McDonald running for the state Supreme Court as a judicial referee appointed by the Minnesota Supreme Court is recommending that McDonald be placed on supervised probation for 1 year for causing harm to both the public and legal profession. And what that essentially means is that if Michelle McDonald were to somehow pull off a miracle and get elected to the state Supreme Court, she would have to face her current Supreme Court colleagues who would have to decide whether to suspend her from practicing law for 90 days. Yeah, that is someone who potentially could be on the state Supreme Court who would have their law license suspended by the state board. Yeah, unreal. So do make sure you vote on the backside of your ballot in those judicial elections. All right, we got to take a break, but coming up next, we are going to be talking with a couple of filmmakers who recently made a documentary about Pepe the Frog. If you're not familiar with Pepe, he's an online meme symbol of those on the alt-right, and we're going to talk more about that coming up next. So stay with us here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
Whether you love it or hate it, winter is upon us. Start preparing before it is too late. Bundle up and save some cash. This fall is the perfect time for Standard Heating and Air Conditioning's Bundle Up for Savings Sale, where you can save at least $1,000 on a new high-efficiency furnace. Winter does not wait, and neither will this deal. Find out today how you can save $1,000 or more on your new furnace at standardheating.com/specials. Standard Heating and Air Conditioning, the comfort you deserve since 1930.
Hazel's Northeast is back and offering some of the most creatively prepared comfort food you'll find. Delicious breakfast options include the slow-cooked brisket hash, chicken fried steak, and the famed drunken banana French toast. Or for lunch and dinner, there's Swedish meatballs, wild rice gumbo, and more. Hazel's Northeast is open Wednesdays through Saturdays, 8 to 8, and Sundays, 9 to 2. Hazel's Northeast delivers real good food. Family-owned at 29th and Johnson in Minneapolis. Make your reservation now at hazelsnetogo.com.
These days, our home is the center of our world. This is Gregory Rich, founder of Habitation Furnishing and Design and host of Drink in the Style right here on AM 950. If we're all going to be spending a lot more time at home, doesn't it make sense to make your space the most attractive and most functional space it can be? At Habitation, my experienced, degreed interior design staff can help you select the perfect furnishings for your home and your lifestyle. Furniture is more than one size fits all, and there's more to making a room work than a couple of chairs and a sofa. Whether it's a modular, sectional, carefully selected to maximize your living room, or the perfect bed, dresser, and nightstand combination to create your dream bedroom, Habitation can help you achieve the space you've always wanted. So check us out online at habitationdesign.com or schedule an appointment at our Edina showroom. Habitation Furnishing and Design. Make your home exceptional.
Do you believe in ghosts? Ever wondered if aliens from other planets visit the Earth? Have you ever thought about whether Bigfoot is real? My name is Greg Bakken, and on my new show, Ghost Box Radio, we'll have these conversations about the paranormal, ufology, Bigfoot, or just the unusual, bringing together guests who are experts in these fields. Join me every Sunday at 4 p.m. for Ghost Box Radio with Greg Bakken on AM 950. Even if you're a skeptic.
Hi, I'm Alicia Luther-Toms, Certified Financial Planner with RBC Wealth Management. I'm part of an all-woman financial advisor team with combined experience of over 40 years. Whether it's leaving something for your loved ones, enjoying your own retirement, or giving to a favorite charity, we'll help you plan, and there's no better time than right now. This is Alicia Luther-Toms at 612-770-4460 or alicia.luther.toms@rbc.com.
RBC Wealth Management, a division of RBC Capital Markets, LLC, member NYSE, FINRA, SIPC.
And we're back on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's FYI, Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, one of the big symbols that has emerged, especially since Donald Trump ran for president, is Pepe the Frog. You've probably seen him all over the internet, on message boards, on social media, and so on and so on. It's that green frog, usually with that caption that says, "Feels good, man." But it was an image that got co-opted by the far right, as it originally was not a far right symbol, Pepe the Frog. So joining us to talk more about this is Arthur Jones and Giorgio Angelini, as they recently directed a documentary called Feels Good Man, as they talk about the phenomenon of Pepe the Frog and how it was co-opted by the far right and how the original author and creator of Pepe is trying to get that image back. So, Arthur, Giorgio, thanks so much for joining me today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us on.
Absolutely. So how did this image get co-opted in the first place? I wasn't completely familiar with the history, but Pepe's actually been around since 2005, it sounds like, well before Trump ran for president.
That is true. Pepe started out as a comic book character, not on the internet, but on the page. And, you know, Pepe appeared in a comic book drawn by Matt Fury. It was named Boys Club, and there was one page of Pepe the Frog that really kind of took off. It was a page in the comic where, and I apologize for your listeners, this is all going to sound a little ridiculous, but it's a page in where Pepe is standing in the bathroom. He's peeing with his pants pulled all the way down around his ankles so that his shorts are on the floor, and one of his roommates accidentally barges in on him. And he calls him out for peeing with his pants pulled all the way down around his ankles. And Pepe says, "Feels good, man." And that panel, that catchphrase, for whatever reason, went viral through, Matt had nothing to do with it. It just went viral. Then over a 10-year period, Pepe became a reaction image. He went from the "Feels good, man" frog to the "Feels sad, man frog to the "Feels bad, man" frog. And he became this emotional avatar for people online. And as the politics in America grew angrier and angrier, Pepe became an emblem for aggrievement online. He was now an angry frog. He was a homicidal, rageful frog. He was a smug frog. He was a character that was used in trolling. And so our film traces how Matt kind of lost control of his character in the same way the nation kind of lost control of its politics. And this is a story about how trolling moved off of the message boards that Pepe was popular on and then just became our mainstream politics. And so, that's kind of the general arc of Feels Good Man.
So why on earth did far-right extremists find Pepe so appealing? Why specifically did they go with him? Is it even possible to answer that question?
We certainly tried to in the film. it's complicated, but I think once you spend time with the film, you start to see how actually maybe logical it is. I mean, Pepe really first starts off, like Arthur said, as a kind of mascot for the internet. And so you have like a lot of young men who are predominantly kind of inventing a lot of the culture of early internet culture. And Pepe becomes kind of the de facto mascot for that movement. But then as the internet becomes more commercialized and as social media starts to become more popular, you start to see Pepe being used by people in the mainstream. And for the early adopters of Pepe, that was kind of offensive to them. And so their natural reaction, which you might maybe compare to like punk rock in the 70s or something, their natural reaction was to sort of Nazify Pepe in some sense, to make Pepe grotesque and ugly and unattractive and unappealing to the masses. And I think from that point, you saw political opportunists kind of see Pepe as this very useful tool, this useful icon for rage that they felt was worthy of tapping into very cynically and opportunistically. And so it's kind of like this combination of both natural cultural progression of the hive mind on the internet plus some really cynical political opportunists and professional racists online taking Pepe to use for their own personal gain.
And Pepe is a very unique 21st century dog whistle, or that's the way he was used in 2016, where people could use a Pepe and say something tremendously offensive. And then they could just step away from that and be like, no, I'm only kidding. This was all just a joke. My intentions can't be true. And in fact, you're an idiot for thinking that they might be. Yeah.
And like, how could they? I'm using this silly, stupid frog. Like, how dare you think that I'm being serious?
And so you had people like Richard Spencer, who's a white supremacist, see the power in Pepe. He saw that Pepe was popular amongst a group of angry, disenfranchised men. And then he also saw that Pepe was something that the media didn't know how to deal with. If he wore a Pepe pin, which he started to do, he could sort of say that, like, oh, this is just a silly frog Pepe pin. It can't mean that I believe in the ethno state. But in reality, he believes in the ethno state, and he's winking at a group of people online whenever he wears Pepe the Frog in public. And so, you know, our movie is really this unique case study that Pepe provides for us. It's this moment of media literacy where we see these niche online communities affecting our mainstream politics. And, you know, this is happening again 4 years later. Our film took place in 2016, and now in 2020, we see QAnon, which is this joke that started on 4chan, now we have to take seriously because now it's bleeding out into reality again, and now is becoming part of basically, you know, reactionary politics in America.
We're speaking with Arthur Jones and Giorgio Angelini. They are the producer and director of Feels Good Man, a new documentary about Pepe the Frog, the alt-right meme that is set to air coming up on Monday, October 19th. Final question for you guys here. I know Matt Fury, the original creator of Pepe, is trying to win it back and try to get his image back and away from being a right-wing symbol, but isn't this almost the case where memes almost become more powerful than the creators and kind of proof that, well, nobody really owns anything on the internet once you publish something?
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, memes, you know, there's a reason why Michael Bloomberg spent millions of dollars to hire young kids to try to make political memes. Obviously, he didn't fundamentally understand how they work because, you know, you can't really calculate their power, right? That's part of the wonder of how memes work. But the power also of what internet memes do is they kind of serve to democratize propaganda in this kind of perverse way. It inverts the relationship that the electorate has with the politician in the sense that if you as a single voter out there can create a really moving image, a really interesting meme that then gets retweeted by maybe even the president, you've now like very directly engaged in the political machinery. And so this is kind of like a first, I think, for humanity, and we're starting to see how it plays out. And, you know, like Arthur said, Pepe is this incredible case study that hopefully, like, serves as a piece of media literacy for the general public to kind of understand how to engage the online world more intelligently and skeptically, maybe.
Yeah, and, you know, I think, it, you know, things can't be controlled online, and I think Matt knows that to a certain degree, but what we can try to do is like seek understanding and then try to like establish agency. And so, you know, Matt is doing what he can to try to turn the narrative of Pepe around, and he's doing that in a variety of ways. He's first letting people know what his true intentions for the character are, and so that when you would see a hateful version of Pepe, you would at least know that it was a corruption of the more innocent Pepe that he'd envisioned. And he is enforcing his copyright, and that's been a powerful tool for him. He knows that it's not going to like necessarily solve the problem, but what he can do is take on the propagandists who are and the grifters who are seeking either to like gain further attention or to make money off of the character. And that's actually been like a pretty potent thing for him. And so in the movie, I think the viewer sees themselves in Matt in some way, in the same way Pepe was stolen from Matt and he's grappling with like how to deal with it. You know, we feel as though like the attention economy has stolen culture from all of us to a certain degree. We're all sort of now part of the psychic doom scroll of the 24-hour news cycle. And so, you know, our reality sometimes feels like it's out of control. And so we hope that this film is kind of a reconfirmation of Pepe as a symbol for positivity as Matt first envisioned him, and also a reconfirmation of our shared reality, that we're above the sort of transhuman moment of, you know, social media, and that we can connect with our very real community in a engaged, often offline way.
We've been speaking with Arthur Jones, director, and Giorgio Angelini, producer of the new documentary Feels Good Man, about Pepe the Frog, who now, of course, is a symbol of the alt-right movement. That documentary premieres coming up on Monday on PBS. Encourage you to check it out. I'll be watching that myself. And Arthur, Giorgio, really appreciate the time today.
Thank you so much.
And again, a big thanks to Arthur Jones and Giorgio Angelini, the directors of the new documentary Feels Good Man, which premieres today, and you can find that over on PBS. All right, that's just about all the time I got for my show today. Matt McNeil is coming up next.
Connections Radio Show is all about tapping into our hardwired hunger to connect. We examine meaningful connections to ourselves, our community, and the world around us. By opening the door to innovative insights by a wide variety of interesting guests, we'll make the connections to something bigger than ourselves. Join me, Lori Fitz, your host of Connections Radio Show, and together, we'll make the connections. Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Next time on Philosophy Talk, why we hate.
White nationalist and neo-Nazi hate groups are on the rise around the globe.
Ugh, I hate those guys.
Well, I don't like them either, but shouldn't we be trying to love more, hate less?
I don't know. Isn't it appropriate to hate hateful people? Because the players gonna play,
and the haters gonna hate. Why we hate. Next time on Philosophy Talk.
Philosophy Talk, every Sunday at 8 a.m. and again at 2 p.m. on AM 950.
Your need-to-know news headquarters.